The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us this week, oh boy, are we happy about this, is Yancey Roy, the Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday. And by the way, there's nobody in Albany, if they're of right mind, who doesn't know that Yancey is right on the case. Welcome, Yancey.
Thanks for having me.
Well, anytime, because we think that you're terrific and you make a great show. So let's talk about redistricting. The state legislature has now rejected the maps proposed by the redistricting commission. So they set up a redistricting commission. They say, too much of this political stuff. We're going to have a commission who's going to call it balls and strikes as they see them. And then when they issue their report, they say, nothing doing. Both houses are controlled by the Democrats, and the governorship is controlled by the Democrats. So let's see. What do you have to say for yourself on this, Yancey?
Well, you know, let's jump back to when this was created, which was about 10 years ago, when they, every 10 years, you have to do redistricting per the census. And at the time, Governor Cuomo, there was a Republican majority in the Senate, Democrat in the Assembly. Redistricting has always been political. It's always been heavily criticized because it helps those typically in power. And they created this idea of a commission 10 years ago, sort of as a fig leaf, really, for like, okay, we're going to do redistricting the old-fashioned political way now, but in 10 years, we'll pass it off to a commission, and it won't be political anymore, which, I mean, redistricting is always political. So it is kind of just a, you know, like I say, a fig leaf for getting redistricting done last time. So fast forward to now, how is the commission created? Well, as the watchdogs say, it wasn't really an independent commission. It was a commission made up of five Republican appointees and five Democratic appointees. And when you got five and five, the idea that they're going to reach a conclusion or have a majority decision is just sort of naive, that they're always going to vote five and five, they're always going to vote in a block. And so that's sort of what happened this time, is that the Democrat commissioners came up with a set of maps for Congress and for the state legislature, and the Republicans came up with their own version as well. Lo and behold, what a shocker. They couldn't agree on one set of maps. Each side forwarded their own set to the legislature, which was soundly and in a bipartisan way, soundly rejected this week at the state capitol. I mean, one of the votes in the assembly, I believe, was 142-4. Another one was 140-6. So, you know, no matter what side of the aisle you were on, you pretty much voted against these maps. So what does this mean, though, for the people? What this means is just another step towards what's probably going to happen in New York and happens pretty much in every state, is that the state legislature itself draws the lines. And folks might say, well, they're self-interested. They're protecting, you know, congressional districts in Texas. The Republicans control the process, and they try to help Republicans. In New York, it's Democrats control. They'll probably try to help new Democrats. All of that is true. Everyone likes to say they'd like to do it in a fair, you know, independent way. But it's one of those arguments where, you know, either side says, well, the Republicans are doing this here, so the Democrats have to do this to protect their side in other states. And so, you know, it's one of those where, until like all the states sort of do some sort of independent redistricting, I don't know if you can really expect any of them to commit to an independent process.
So we're all in the rowboat on this thing. The question is, who tips the rowboat over, and what is the potential for such a tipping? In other words, right now the Democrats control everything. They're going to draw the maps in New York State in the way that benefits them the most. Now, we know the Supreme Court finds it anathematic. If that is the right word, I don't know. But I can tell you they don't like getting involved in this. And years ago, Justice Frankfurter, when he was on the court, said, we're going to avoid this whole thing of gerrymandering. It's the political thicket, and we want to stay out of it. So I don't think once the maps come up in New York State, there's going to be any real hope of changing anything if anybody wants to.
Well, you can always file a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit. Right. That's happened before. You might say that there's a chance, look, these maps are going to be drawn by a Democratic-controlled legislature. Is there a possibility that a Republican, after the maps are out, files suit and seeks a federal judge to draw the districts? That's happened before. Federal judges have, courts have ended up having the final say on maps in New York before. But, and this is important, those cases, when that happened, it was because, again, there was a Republican-controlled Senate in New York and a Democratic-controlled Assembly, and having a federal judge act as the final referee was kind of, in a way, signed off by both sides, and that's what happened. This time, it's different. There's one party controls both houses. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Republican Party down the road try to challenge any kind of district maps. But in general, what you have to do with these maps to have them thrown out by a judge is they have to violate some aspect of federal voting protections. And there is some leeway there. And as long as you're complying with various federal protections about, you know, equal representation and all of that, you can, and we've seen this in other states, you can draw the maps that help your political party and it still pass federal muster.
So when the federal judges did it, because, you know, we have Republican judges and Democratic judges, the question I had for you, Yancey, is based on your observations, were the maps somewhat more fair than they would have been if it was done in the legislative process?
Well, keep this in mind. In past, and certainly in the last couple of rounds of redistricting, especially in the congressional side, New York typically tended to lose two seats at a time. And sort of the unspoken agreement was basically when the congressional maps were drawn, each party kind of lost an incumbent, if you will. If memory serves, and you'll remember this too, I think in 2000, wasn't it John LaFalce from Buffalo, and a Democrat, and Ben Gilman, a Republican from Orange County, Hudson Valley. Both of their districts were kind of, well, rubbed out and taken over, cannibalized into other districts. And so it made trade-offs a little easier. This time New York is losing one congressional seat, and practically speaking, it's what's probably going to happen is that it's going to be a Republican seat that gets sort of swallowed up somewhere else on the state map, probably almost in very much likelihood somewhere upstate. I don't know if that's it's more the North Country, more central New York, more the southern tier, but it's probably going to be one of those Republican districts that kind of just gets, again, swallowed up by other districts. Because the state does have to reduce its number of congressional districts. Upstate has not grown at the same rate as downstate, and that's why it's more likely to happen upstate.
Okay, let me get this straight, because I was talking with a congressman. It was a private conversation, so I don't think I should use his name. A Democrat who is being screwed by this last set of maps. Why would that be?
You know, whatever people say about the set of maps that were produced by the commission, I mean, the main thing you could say about the commission maps is throw them straight in the trash. They're not going to mean much of anything. They've been voted down once. The commission, technically speaking, legally speaking, now gets another chance to draw maps and come up with a unified set of maps. I don't think that that's likely to happen. So what will happen certainly by the end of this month is the state legislature will be working on maps. I don't know how soon we'll see them. I don't think it'll actually take that long because the census data has been out since last fall, the detailed data. And there is a legislative redistricting task force that's been operable for decades. It's never gone out of business, which compiles all of this data. So if someone says boy, these commission maps hurt my district, hurt Democrats, hurt Republicans. All of those commission maps are going to be irrelevant pretty soon if they're not already.
Gotcha. Do those people get paid for what they do?
Yeah, right. It's a small, I don't know off the top of my head how many people are assigned to that committee, but it's been part of the legislative branch for decades.
Now, in New York City, there is quite a to-do, a kerfuffle over non-citizens' right to vote. It's now enshrined in law. Starting next year, 800,000 legal permanent residents will be eligible to vote in municipal elections. I think a lot of people are holding their noses on that. It's always been you should be a citizen in order to vote. What do you say?
Well, it's certainly going to be sort of a lightning rod for politics. As you saw, the Republican state chairman, Nick Langworthy, joined by some of his party members, filed a lawsuit this week against that law to try to eventually knock it out in the courts. I think what else is very, very clear is that Langworthy and the Republicans will try to use this issue in every election in the state in New York. Even if the law is particularly about New York City voting, I think you will see it brought into issues about in Long Island and Westchester, upstate. It'll be, look what these Democrats are doing. Do you agree with this? And they're going to, it will in likelihood win them some support in some areas. It just depends on how big of an issue it is. But it's definitely going to be used in the election, even in elections statewide, even what we're seeing for statewide office holders, of course, are coming up this year, even if the issue is particularly about New York City voting.
Yancy Roy, you're one very bright guy, and you'll explain to me, what in hell could the Democrats have been thinking they were doing when they passed this law in New York City?
Well, you see, the rationale is that, again, just broadly speaking, I don't want to speak for them, but the general idea is that you're talking about people who have been in the country for a long time. The immigration system is backed up in terms of people trying to gain citizenship. They are working, productive members of society and affected by policies that are passed by elected officials and therefore should have a choice in that. Now, you know the opposite argument, which you kind of touched on before, is that the idea is that you have to have citizenship to be able to cast a vote in an election. Again, I think it's going to be played up a lot as we go forward in this election year.
Yancy Roy, that brings up the other thing that the Democrats may be sorry they started up with, and that's the concept of bail reform. The Republicans, as you suggest, can get together and say, this is a hot one. We're going to win some votes on this. And they sure did on the question of bail reform. Could you explain that process to us?
Okay, so when the Democrats took over the state legislature in 2019, one of their big agenda items was criminal justice. And one of those items was changing the bail laws. There were horror stories of someone gets accused of a crime. You get set, posted like $10,000 bail. Well, you're low income and your family can't post it. And then you sit in jail months, maybe even years, before your case comes up because the cases are so backed up. And Kalief Browder was sort of the emblematic of this argument that sat in there for, I don't remember off the top of my head how long, but more than a year in jail, awaiting a charge on a minor offense. And that this was unfair because people who are wealthy can easily post bail or have a bondsman post bail and be out. And so the idea was two sets of justices, one for those who can afford it and one for those who can't. So in sum, and this is simplifying things, but what they did was pass a law that basically said almost all misdemeanors are not going to be subject to bail, and that if you're charged with a misdemeanor crime, a judge will not be able to hold you on bail. And also nonviolent felonies, a judge will not be able to hold you on bail. That was passed in 2019. There was a great backlash at the time because there were some anecdotal cases of people getting out and committing horrendous crimes. So the backlash came, and in 2020, the Democrats amended the law to add back dozens of cases of crimes, including such as, I believe, burglary, where a person's in the home invasion, where someone's in the house, and there could be a safety issue. They added dozens of crimes back to the bail eligible list. But still, By and large, most misdemeanors are not going to be subject to bail. The Republicans effectively use this law, especially on campaigns in Long Island for district attorney, where they just walloped their Democratic candidates and pulled off a couple of surprises and even beat the Nassau County incumbent Democratic executive. So certainly they're going to keep using that again in 2022, whether it's in state elections or in, you know, state assembly, state Senate. Interesting thing, the state Department of Criminal Justice Services and the Office of Court Administration came out with a report this week, updated statistics on some of the bail and who's being held and are they rearrested. Except that the issue, in a way, the statistics are collected and presented in a way that don't necessarily clarify it definitively for either side of the argument. In fact, it kind of gives arguments to either side. It said that basically a very low percentage of people who are released or who are charged with something and released, a very low percentage of them ever are rearrested for a violent crime, something like 3% or less. At the same time, it said that there are high rearrest rates for some people who are released, especially those who are released but placed on some sort of what's called non-monetary supervision, which is you got to wear the ankle bracelet or you got to check in regularly with the court or law enforcement. I know there's a high percentage of folks there who are rearrested for other crimes. And Republicans will say it's not only the percentage, but it's also the volume because there's more people who are released now. So those numbers are out there. They, you know, they kind of provide ammo for either side. And I think you're going to see a lot of either side using that as we go forward in this election year.
And where is the ever competent governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, on this question?
Well, I think people took notice that she did not mention the issue at all in her State of the State address. So that means it's not on her to-do list right now. Doesn't mean something won't happen, but certainly Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins from Yonkers was asked last week about the issue, and she said right now we don't have plans to address bail reform. We are always looking at the numbers. We will always monitor it. But, and I'm paraphrasing here, she said we're not going to make changes and an overreaction because, you know, there's been anecdotes of here or there when the number of people who are rearrested for violent crimes is very, very small.
And yet, based on the effectiveness, Yancey Roy, of how the Republicans used it the last time, you would think they would run for the hills on this one.
You know, Todd Kominsky is a state senator from Long Beach, which is Nassau County, the western edge of Nassau County. He wanted to become Nassau district attorney, and he ran a campaign there. The Democrats had been holding the DA's office for a while in Nassau, but he was a senator who voted for the bail overhaul. He voted for the first one, and he was a guy who even was one of the most vocal in pushing for the amendment in 2020 to add a whole slew of crimes back to being bail eligible. But even if he was in that position and could say, oh, I spearheaded the changes, well, that didn't do him much good with the electorate in the local election last November. He got walloped. He lost badly to the Republicans, who just pounded that issue. Todd Kominsky voted for bail laws, you know, over and over and over, and it became sort of a central issue in that campaign, especially because, well, frankly, it's for district attorney, which is for prosecuting crimes. Does it come up and play as well in a race for state senator or governor? That's what we'll see played out later this year.
Okay, so Governor Hochul, in her State of the State, proposed term limits for the governor and other statewide offices. So what are the chances of this is happening? I do know that when it happened in one Cuomo administration or the other, they said, yeah, it's a good idea. Let's start with the controller who they aided. So what's likely to happen with this?
I don't know. Right now, it's hard to say. You can say, look, point out this, that there's 36 states who have some sort of limit on a governor's term. And not all of those, and very few of those, have limit on the legislative body's term. And in some ways, doesn't that mirror what our federal system is in Washington? The president is limited to 8 years, 2 consecutive terms, while members of Congress can stay. There's no term limit on them. So the idea, I think for a long time, the idea was that no governor necessarily favored this and would always try to, like, tie it into, okay, let's have term limits for state legislators as well. And then the idea pretty much died. But this makes it different that it's the governor herself who is pushing for this and saying that there's a term limit. I think there's a couple of strategic things there. One is that Kathy Hochul has tried to over and over say, I'm not Cuomo. And so for her coming out for this puts her in distinction from Andrew Cuomo, who had won three terms, who had publicly said he was planning on running for a fourth term. And also look at New York's history. I mean, we've had a long history of governors who serve a long time. Andrew Cuomo won three terms. George Pataki, three terms. Mario Cuomo, three terms. Nelson Rockefeller was in his fourth term when he left. And the argument for the term limit on a governor is somewhat like it is with a president. When you say, why limit the chief executive and not the legislators? Well, the chief executive, the governor in this state, has so much power, so much more power than the legislature to control the budget, to control state policies, that the argument is that is different than, you know, a rank and file legislator from Albany County and how much that person, how much power or sway that person has. When you have the chief executive, you're talking about one person sort of dominating state policy for a very long time, which we just recently saw. And then that's the reason for the argument for, well, maybe we should join 36 other states and limit a governor's term.
But of course, Yancey Roy, there's no doubt that the New York State legislators are not going to vote to limit their own terms.
Highly unlikely. Well, again, there's an argument that says everyone, there should be turnover in all the offices. That's one argument. And then the other one is that is to say that the governor's office, the chief executive, is different because, frankly, look at the state budget. A governor always gets at least 90% of what he or she usually wants in that budget, and the legislators are just kind of on the edges of that. So the argument is that this office is a different one. But again, I don't know. We'll see if the legislature has the interest in doing that.
Well, let me just say that once you're ensconced in power in the New York State legislature, it shouldn't be this way, in my opinion, but it is. So we see somebody like Dick Gottfried, who was exemplary, served for, I believe, 51 years. I knew him when he was the youngest, and I knew him on the way out when he was among the oldest. So don't you think these guys, once they get elected to the legislature, think that they own that spot? And truthfully, they may.
There is very little turnover in the state legislature. Frankly, there has been more in the last 10 years than there probably has for decades before that. And that's because of a variety of things. In fact, the split on the Democratic side between progressives and the mainstream. But by and large, New York has had like a very, very low turnover rate. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I want to say it's about like 98% reelection rate. Especially if you, and that the only way people would leave the legislature is retirement, death, or indictment. There was a little bit of change. That has changed. We've seen it in the state Senate recently. But yeah, you're right. Generally, overall, once someone is in, and especially once you win reelection one or two times, you're usually set for almost as long as you want to stay there.
There for life. So how about all those criminal complaints, including by David Soares, which were dismissed against Andrew Cuomo? I've been predicting that I know Cuomo well enough, having interviewed him a lot of times, is that, you know, he may actually figure this was redemption and he can get back into the primary. Any chance you think that'll happen?
I don't know. He certainly got a lot of campaign money left aside. Roughly $18 million. Oh, and by the way, mark it on your calendar. January 18th, later this month, is another campaign finance filing date. You'll not only get to see how much Kathy Hochul and other would-be governors have raised, you'll also be able to see how much Andrew Cuomo has used from his campaign fund in the last 6 months, either fighting these various investigations or the criminal complaints. I know people have speculated that, well, he's not charged. Cuomo is not charged criminally. He could always come back. I think the circumstances would have to be right. He would certainly, even if he's not charged criminally, it certainly is had a lot of damage politically to him through this set of investigations that took place over the last year.
Now, Kathy Hochul, the governor, signed anti-discrimination laws spurred by Newsday housing probe. Tell us more.
Yeah, this was a long investigation that Newsday had done over several years. It was called Long Island Divided, where you had people going to real estate offices as would-be house purchasers and recording their interactions with agents. And the broad stroke here is that basically people of color, whether they were Hispanic or Black or Asian, often saw different treatment from agents, whether it was requiring pre-approved mortgages or steering them to or away certain neighborhoods. And we published all of those findings a couple of years ago in an extensive piece, and it sparked hearings by the state legislature and investigation. And the end result is a number of laws were signed by the governor, I want to say 10 or 11, right at the end of December, which did a lot of things, required more training for real estate agents, raised the fines for violation of fair housing laws, and also up the biannual registration fees for agents and brokers to fund what will potentially be, as we go forward, investigations by the state, where they go out by themselves. The newspaper doesn't have to do it, but they go out by themselves, find out if real estate agents are still doing the same practices or if they've changed their ways in the light of these law changes.
The fact that so many newspapers are, being told that they're ineffective, they can't do anything anymore, this shows one victory for the news media.
Well, it shows that, local journalism still has an impact in ways all the time. So, yeah.
We are out of time. Our guest has been Yancey Roy, the Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday. Thank you so much, Yancey, for being with us. It's always wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Al.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or you can even schedule a podcast. Ask for program number 2202. And join us again next week at this same time for another Political Conversation with Alan Chartok. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.